Okay, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the first session after lunch. Possibly the biggest risk in the world, culture. So we have three glorious presenters from Deloitte. Sharanjeet, he's a principal at Deloitte. He has over 20 years' experience in general insurance and accident compensation. Sharanjeet has acted as appointed actuary to a number of insurers, reinsurers, and specializes in natural disasters and measuring environmental and social impact. He, as a lot of you might know, he also is an editor of Actuaries Digital and convenes the Actuaries Institute Climate Change Working Group. Second presenter is Gloria. Gloria is a director at Deloitte, Actuaries and Consultants, and has been working in the GI field since 2001. Experience spans Australia and Asia Pacific and includes fulfilling statutory actuary roles for a number of Asia Pac, GI and general insurers and reinsurers, and leading risk management framework reviews for a few Australian insurers. Gloria is also actively involved with the Actuaries Institute. She was a member of the board of the Institute from 2009 to 2014 and continues to serve on a number of committees. Gloria, interesting fact on Gloria, besides being an FIAA, she holds a diploma in music and is also a licentiate. Is that how you say it? of the UK Associated Board of the Royal School of Music, specialising in piano performance. Our third presenter is Brad Aldridge. Brad is a manager at Deloitte and has over 8 years of consulting experience in GI, reinsurance, super, across Australia, New Zealand, South Africa and broader Africa. His focus has largely been risk-based regulatory regimes and assisting with appointed actuary services, risk and solvency assessments, and other ad hoc projects. Brad also has active involvement in research and product development across super and has assisted regulatory work across Africa in developing and implementing risk-based regulatory regimes. So I welcome the first presenter, Brad.
Hi, everyone. As you heard, we'll be talking about why risk culture is possibly the biggest risk in the world. We'd just like to acknowledge the Management Information on Culture, Connecting the Dots report, which was prepared by Deloitte in partnership with three of its regulatory strategy centres. I'll be discussing why risk culture may be the biggest risk in the world, and then hand over to Gloria to discuss what is risk culture and why is it relevant to actuaries. And then Sharanjeet will be discussing what can we do about it and look at a target culture as an example.
Apple's up more than 6% right now, Google about 3%, but Dell, Intel, Research Motion, and Microsoft are all to the upside. Look how strong.
Did not disappoint. 400 points higher. Yes, indeed. The markets roar higher. Last 30 minutes of trading as volatility once again rules the day.
Most of the techs this morning, if not all of them, have just exploded to the upside. We are better than 5% to the upside at NASDAQ 114.
From the financial capital of the world, the opening bell is going to ring in 5 seconds, and to be honest with you, we wish it wouldn't.
Trying to get to the bottom of what really caused the 2008 meltdown.
The consequences of this financial crisis have been grim also. 27 million Americans who are either out of work, can't find full-time work, or stop looking for work. Millions who have lost their homes and millions more who are in the foreclosure process. Trillions of dollars of wealth loss. I think one of our jobs is to try to rationally explain to people what the heck happened.
Down 1.7% here, a loss of 37 points or so. Apple shares are just getting hammered this morning.
We're down by between 3 and 4.5% generally across these markets. Let's talk about the speed with which we are watching this market deteriorate. We're red everywhere, essentially, down by 4, 5%.
We're down over 16%. Dow, at the same time, has fallen about 18%.
The stock market is now down 21%.
Because we're now down 43%.
What in the world is happening on Wall Street?
Look at the move in Aussie yen just this week. This was 1 week, Maria. This market took 5 years to go higher. It's now down 40%.
What started in America last year has now spread to every part of the world.
We haven't seen anything like this probably since the Great Depression, I think it's fair to say.
We've had an 8-day losing streak in the Dow that in percentage terms puts it on par, close to the loss suffered in that crash in 1987, close to that percentage loss those 2 days in 1929.
And this is just a sobering reminder of how connected we all are across the globe. And if something goes wrong, it can have a tremendous impact in a very short period of time. And it's the loss of houses, the loss of jobs, that are just some of the consequences that can be felt for a long time thereafter. And the sad reality is this is just one instance, and we don't have to look far to see the impact of poor risk culture. We've seen HIH and more recently issues with how things have been done in life insurance. We've also seen issues raised about conduct in general insurance. And the headlines remind us that whether it's LIBOR rate manipulation, mis-selling of policies, or any other public meltdown, that many features of a sound risk culture would not have been present. And I was watching a TED talk by Naomi Klein, who some may not be a fan of, and The TED talk was called Addicted to Risk, and it's followed shortly after the BP oil spill. And Naomi goes on to discuss how we've kept telling ourselves that our tools and technology could control nature, and suddenly we were faced with our weakness, our lack of control, as oil burst out of every effort to contain it. And I'd like to quote what she said. Even more striking than the ferocious power emanating from that well was the recklessness with which that power was unleashed, the carelessness and the lack of planning that characterized the operation from drilling to cleanup. And what Naomi has said reminds us that societies have developed a culture where they've been too willing to gamble with things that are precious without a backup plan, without an exit strategy. And while we are operating in an environment where risks are intentionally taken and need to be taken, it's when a company or its employees have become overconfident that they take bigger risks than they normally would have or that they should have. And this morning we heard Win Lee talk about how driverless cars, for example, are already a reality. And in Western Australia, they're testing driverless buses. And it's such an incredible time to be alive and witness the giant leaps that are being made. But as companies are pursuing the next big thing, the stakes are higher than ever. Human life itself, and as Kate also mentioned this morning, our climate are at risk. And the leaders of an organization have to be aware that, whether they are conscious of it or not, they are constantly signaling risk culture to their employees. And what is acceptable risk to take and what the consequences are or what they should be of taking risks. I'll hand you over to Gloria.
Thanks, Brad. So what is culture? There are many, many definitions, and here's just one. Culture can be thought of as a system of values, beliefs, and behaviors that influence how work gets done within an organization. Or put simply, what people do in an organization, the way we do things. Culture is different from compliance in that compliance is about what you can do, whereas culture is about what you actually do when nobody is watching. So an insurer's corporate culture permeates all aspects of its business, whether it's attitudes towards risk-taking, customer treatment, compliance with rules, innovation, diversity and inclusion, empowerment of staff to make decisions, the time horizon over which costs and benefits are considered, just to name a few. An insurer's culture reflects how its staff think, behave, and act, and consequently influences business results. And so developing a culture that is right for the business can increase profitability, customer satisfaction, and reduce risks and employee turnover. Getting it wrong, though, can be disastrous. As we saw in the video just then, it can lead to the financial crisis, mis-selling fines, and even criminal acts. So that's culture. What about risk culture? Well, risk culture is the influence of organizational culture on how risks are managed in an organization. In simple terms, risk culture is the way we do risk, the way we handle risk. It is how staff identify, understand, discuss, and act on the risks an organization confronts and takes. All organizations have a risk culture, regardless whether it is actively considered or managed. And there are subcultures within a single organization. For an institution's risk management framework, including risk governance, to be effective, there must be a strong risk culture, which is consistent with the company's espoused values and its risk appetite. So risk culture is still a pretty abstract concept, pretty complex. Why should actuaries be interested in risk culture? Well, intuitively, given culture has such a big influence on how much risk an insurer takes on and therefore how much capital is required to support those risks, and ultimately the financial viability of the organization, actuaries should naturally want to be involved and be engaged with risk culture, as we are the stewards of a company's financial conditions. But I'm sure as Stuart reminded us here that there are also prudential standards that ensure that we focus on risk management, of which a big part is risk culture. CPS 220. APRA makes it clear that the board is ultimately responsible for the risk management framework, which sets out the risk management strategy and includes the risk appetite, amongst many other things. Risk management framework has to be appropriate to the size, business mix, and complexity of the insurer, and enables it to appropriately develop and implement strategies, policies, procedures, and controls to manage different types of material risks and provides the board with a comprehensive institution-wide view of material risks. Under GPS 110, the ICAP must, at a minimum, include adequate policies, procedures, systems, and controls and personnel to identify, measure, monitor, and manage the risks arising from a company's activities on a continuous basis and the capital held against such risks. GPS 320 says that the appointed actuary has a responsibility to include in the FCR a section that assesses the suitability and adequacy of risk management framework. But it's actually an area that is arguably the lightest or the weakest in the FCR, and APRA has certainly indicated a number of times that that section needs to be improved. I suppose one of the ways that we could improve the commentary of this in the FCR is to include relevant information on risk culture. Risk culture is certainly an evolving area, and some of the questions that the board might be asked are, well, how does the board satisfy itself that the espoused values are truly supported by management and staff at all levels, i.e., is the tone at the bottom the same as the tone at the top? Does the board have a clear view of the risk culture to which it aspires for the institution, and how does it assess the prevailing risk culture? Do remuneration and KPIs consistently support and drive the desired risk culture? Well, APRA is certainly intensifying the supervision on risk culture, and some of you would have noticed the paper that APRA released last month on this very topic. In there, APRA indicated that approaches to understanding and managing risk culture are at a relatively early stage of development, and many institutions are grappling with how best to clearly articulate what type of risk culture that they aspire to, identify any specific weaknesses in the current risk culture, and effectively address those weaknesses. So how do we tackle this difficult topic of assessing risk culture? And what can we do as actuaries, as advisors to the board?
Thanks, Gloria. So this is kind of where we sort of try and do some thought experiments and see what we can cobble together around this issue. We kind of made a case so far about why we think we should do something here, and this is an idea about what we could do. As Brad said right at the beginning, a lot of this material comes from work we've done at Deloitte in the UK, but also particularly in the banking sector. And as we're going to step through this, I'm going to sort of suggest about how this could impact what we do on a general insurance sector to try and get more to with the audience that we have here today. But the idea is, you know, if we look at what we do generally in our profession is to, you know, we capture information, we analyze that information and report on that information. And that information generally has, indications for what it means for the solvency and profitability of a company. And really, we're sort of saying, well, what if we did the same thing about risk culture? How could we go about that process? What might it look like? And what would be the tricky things to solve and the rest of it? Now, the big problem with this, and I think this is where this is different, is that my favorite definition of culture is, the one that says it's what people do when they think no one's watching. I think that's the most powerful description of culture, maybe as enacted in the poll booths of the U.S. very recently, for example, revealing what people do in their own privacy. So that makes it also very difficult to measure. I mean, how do you measure something which is what people do when they're not being measured is very difficult. And so there are no hard and fast answers here. There are lots of suggestions. This is a very fluid area. But I think there's some key principles about what we can do. So the framework we want to put around this is, as I said, one developed by our colleagues, and it looks at different ways of piecing together information across an organization, a large organization in this respect, to try and come up with a measure, a regular measure or information about risk culture in an organization and how that might be reported to the boards. So the first thing is that information always needs a context. I'm sure as actuaries we understand that when we do an analysis. We're always clear about what the purpose of our report or analysis is. And the main reason driving this is, of course, that there is a huge risk that information used for not the purpose for which it's intended will be misinterpreted. So everything that we're doing must have a context. And in this way, I think we have to set out what the context for any information we capture on risk culture in an organization is. And the relevant one we're suggesting here, is the target culture of the organization. So this is the tone from the top. What does the organization want its culture to be? And when we are reporting about what the actual cultural information is, we should do it in that context. The next one is objective wherever possible. Now, I imagine with this audience here that I don't need to convince you of the value of objective information. But really what this is about is about inevitably we're going to rely on subjective measures of culture. That's just the inevitable nature of the thing. But how can we expand that subjective culture to take into account more objective measures? So an example here might be, say, where we take, so let's look at underwriting risk and the risks, say, a general insurer might have in its different underwriting departments. And what is the culture within that department about the risk that they take on? Now, if one of the ways that you might measure that might be, through standard things that we have, including, what are the delegated authorities at the various levels, and that's fairly standard. But what about if we look at things like, what's the actual price charge compared to what, say, an actuarially derived price might be? So you compare the actual operations of that department with what an outside benchmark, which is perhaps more objective, might be. Of course, that's suggesting that the actuarial number might be objective, and we know that's not entirely true. But that's an example. Comparisons also of actual loss ratios with what's been happening in the industry generally. So how does this particular underwriting section align with other objective measures that can talk about the level of risk that they take on? We all know the story about every risk management statement says, we have zero tolerance for risk, and what an absurdity that is. But within that, you also have objective information like, well, not necessarily objective, but external information that says, well, what's our strategy? If a company has a strategy where they're pursuing a very high return on investment or return on equity, and at the same time this department is saying we have, you know, very low tolerance of risk, that doesn't stack up. And so by complementing the subjective information with more objective information or external information, we're able to get a better understanding and picture of the risk across the organization. So that's really what this objective wherever possible process is talking about. Also within that is drawn from a range of sources. And the primary reason that we want to use a range of measures to measure risk culture is because otherwise whatever is measured gets managed, and also perhaps gets manipulated. If you have a single source of information about risk culture, then it is at risk of being gamed. So my favorite anecdote about this is an insurance company whose senior management was talking to about and talking about potential concerns around how the business was changing very rapidly and how there were some risks around staff. And they said, oh, no risk at all. We have our annual engagement survey done, and the most recent survey said that we were doing really well. It's really improved since the previous one. We don't think we have any risks around staff. Of course, when you go and talk to the actuarial analyst, who you happen to know, because we're a great profession, we talk to each other, they say, oh, yeah, you know, they changed our engagement survey so that if we reported issues, we had to get together and do this, like, two-hour brainstorm about coming up with solutions for this, and our manager had to lead that. So every time we complained about issues in the engagement survey, we ended up having to do this other process, which we had to do on our own time. So we stopped complaining. That's a true story. Right, but from the top, the organization just sees great engagement survey results, and despite all the rapid disruption they've had, their results are going up. So that's, you get that problem where you rely on a single measure of risk culture, and where you start to look at multiple sources and look at the differences between them, particularly when they're not coherent, you get a much deeper understanding of what's going on in terms of risk culture across an organization. Capture information on subcultures. So this is a kind of, I also see this in the same light as the previous one, where you want to encourage diversity and you want to encourage a broadening of people's reporting of risk. The problem is, if you try and come up with an overall summary of the organization's risk culture, you're a big danger of just reporting about the mean. Right? Whereas we know risk lives in the extremities, lives in the outliers. So you have to, in your management information collection, you have to try and diversify and broaden your risk measures. And one of the very good ways of doing this is to compare different departments. Because when you force a comparison, you force much more granular and much more deeper understanding of different cultures within an organization. So as we say up there, that, you know, one way to look at that is to look at your classic segmentations about different countries, for example. I think the classic one to me at the moment is that we have generally the European and the US regulators, and the markets are calling for a lot more risk aversion amongst departments, a lot more care, a lot more closing down of risk. But at the same time, the Japanese markets and regulators are talking about the problems in their economy because people are not taking enough risk. Right. If you have a multinational organization, you've then got two subcultures around risk. You have one that's all about driving down risk, one that's saying, well, actually, we need to change our ways because we need to take more risk. Otherwise, economy is going to carry on stagnating. The other part of getting into the subcultures that I think is very important, very powerful, is looking at different grades of management. It's very easy, particularly for these things, to focus too much on what's being the tone from the top without listening to the echo from the bottom. And a good place to see where those two mix is in the middle management, because middle management, in the old classic structures, take the strategy and directions and operationalize them and have a whole bunch of people who go away and do that. So, in fact, the way that the culture is transmitted is through the middle management. And if you're not paying enough attention to them and what they're doing, you won't see how the operations of the organizations, line one, are actually going to be what kind of culture they're going to have. So that's an example of that one. Let's talk about the next one, which is evidence-based analysis. So I think this is where, this is a good place for us actuaries to really think about how we do this. So although we've already talked about objective information, we've talked about the types of information we can collect, what we also need to do is make sure that any reporting we do includes an analysis of that information. It's not just facts. It should be an analysis and a synthesis about that, and including recommendations as well. Otherwise, it's not really reporting. Otherwise, it is subject to misinterpretation. These messages can be difficult as well in an organization. To tell an organization that they have a poor risk culture is a very hard thing to do. It's a classic way to set up a sorry, no, go away, and not look at that response. So if you are not presenting analysis and conclusion and recommendations at the same time, you're going to let organizations not face up to any risk culture issues that they have. Along those lines as well is tailored to the audience. We all know the value of any information you provide will only be acted on or taken seriously if it's understood, and different levels of the organizations want different levels of knowledge. And we have to be sensible here. The message is very hard to put across about risk culture, and we need to make it as easy to understand as possible. We're not necessarily been the best at doing this, as I think, as a profession, and I think it's something that would require some more work. We always, I think to how people are talking these days about we don't need data analytics with lots of numbers and things. We actually need insights into what's going on into our business. And I think the same message applies here. Yes, we do want some objective factual information about risk culture, but we also want the insights that come from that, the causes that come from that, and those can't just be numbers and stats. This last one I think is very relevant to... second last one I think is very relevant to us in the general insurance industry today, especially in Australia, where we are seeing unprecedented levels of competition, capacity, overcapacity. We're seeing a large amount of mergers and acquisitions. We're seeing organizations undertaking large transformational projects. We're seeing large changes in staff. We're seeing large transformations in terms of merging life and insurance under one life insurance and general insurance under one business unit. We're seeing a whole bunch of activity within our organizations, which is great. You know, we all know there's good reason for that. There's a big customer deficit, and organizations are rightly trying to address that. But in those periods of rapid change, you are also at risk of having silos in risk culture and having risk culture develop differently to how your target culture is. And so in these times of change, we need much more frequent reporting around this risk culture and much more in-depth reporting around risk culture, particularly, I think, now for the general insurance industry. Lastly, governance and capabilities. This is a management information system, and we know how to do information systems. To do an information system, you have to have proper governance around who designs it, who monitors it, who analyzes it. And we need to put the same level of governance that we do around this that we do under reporting the P&L and reporting the balance sheet through an organization. We also have to make sure we've got the right capabilities, that we have the right people, the right systems, the right IT sections. That's all obvious in motherhood statements, but again, one of the big problems with risk culture in organizations is it's seen as an add-on, as a thing you do extra, as opposed to being at the heart of what's going on. And really, by saying we want governance and capabilities, what we're talking about is saying this is just as important as, or if not more important than everything else that goes in an organization that's reported up. I also want to go back to this target culture thing I talked about, because just go back to the top. And how an organization might set out its target culture. I think there's a few things that we have to think about when we're doing that. One of the ways that the Deloitte research has suggested around talking about target culture is actually to talk about behaviors. And to talk about behaviors, again, in a range of behaviors, not just talking about what our desirable or target behaviors are, but what are actually detrimental behaviors and what are developing behaviors, so that each each part of the organization, each function within the organization can actually rate itself in these issues. And it's very important that you talk about behaviors because, as I said, risk culture is what people do. So behavior, what people actually do when they think no one's watching, right? So that's the definition to bear in mind. So when you want to talk about target culture, it's, you have to talk about things people do, and that's where the behaviors come in. So there are a few examples here that we've got up here. None of these should be surprising to you, but I think what I like about this is how it sets out the range of behaviors and how different behaviors can be measured within different aspects and dimensions of risk management within an organization. And last part about this is cascading down the measurement. So, as I said, the first part here is we talk about the very sorry about the size of those slides. So we talk about the target statement and how that's what the message from the top is by senior management, how that's then set into desirable and undesirable behaviors, the do's and don'ts that then get cascaded down into in further indicators that are measured. If I can see it here, there we go. And then lastly, collecting evidence at the operational level that can be used for metrics and analysis. So this is kind of a framework for how you might do it for an organization. And I think it was quite useful to think about this within the general insurance context. But the one other really important factor here is that, you know, every organization has a unique mix of cultures and unique mix of risks. And so I don't think there is a single template that works for everything, but this is a kind of idea that might have a good start to it. So that's as far as we've got. We're very happy to answer questions people might have at this point in time. I'll hand over to Jazz to chair questions.
Any questions?
I've got one. Thank you for the talk. Given culture is such a broad area and actuaries are certainly not experts on all fields, so how should we go about gauging when to bring in a subject matter expert and who might they be?
That's an interesting thing. You know, what do actuaries do? What are we capable of doing? Should we be the people doing this, or should we not be doing the people doing this? My view is that we should be the people talking about this. That risk culture is a huge stress to the solvency of a company. We have plenty of examples of where there has been ample evidence where the culture within a general insurer has caused the general insurer to become insolvent. I know from the UK as well, Independent Insurance was an example of that. And so I think as if we are to fulfill our role as stewards of the financial solvency of a company, then we need to be across this. And we need to develop tools and methodologies to do that. I'm aware that this isn't a broadly held view in the profession. And certainly, you know, I don't think it's something we can do on our own. Our presentation here is based on the work that other colleagues within Deloitte has done. You know, we've reached out and tried to talk to our risk people about how they go about doing this and to learn from them and to see what works in practice. So there's plenty of risk professionals that we can look to as SMEs, but I still think that it's somewhere where we have to develop our own expertise. Hope that answers your question.
I guess just to add to that, I think the collaboration is the thing of the future as well. So whether it's developing ideas with our risk colleagues or whether it's thinking about other psychologists, for instance, because culture is ultimately about people. And so having that deeper understanding of how human behavior works, what drives somebody to do certain actions, I think that's one of the key things. And so I think actuaries can certainly learn quite a bit from other professions, including psychologists. I think also because of the influence that actuaries have on boards as well, that's one area where we can really, I guess, shape and help shape the strategy around, you know, what is expected as a culture. So rather than having a blame culture whereby people are scared of making mistakes, or just to Sharanji's example earlier about, you know, not actually signaling in the actual survey results that they're not happy with things because of the consequences of it. It's about, I guess, cultivating a culture where it's okay to make mistakes, and these are the things that will prompt, for example, the audit and risk committee to sort of look at, you know, these are some of the metrics and these are the activities that have been reported and these are the issues. And so I suppose in that vein, if you have a management reporting system which says there's zero issues every single quarter, that to me is a sign of there may be an issue actually there.
I think you could describe the approach that you've got as a measurement-based approach. When no one's watching is really a metaphor for when it's not being measured. You agree with that? Yeah. And I didn't hear kind of a conversation about, had a lot of conversation about measures and metrics, but not about principles and how you get principles permeating people's thinking so that when you're not measuring it, it's actually happening. That's culture.
I totally agree. We try to be, you know, this is such a big topic, and we try to focus down on one particular aspect of this topic, which is the measurement part of it. So, you know, that's what I'm saying. But I do agree with you that from my very own thing I said, that, you know, culture is what happens when people aren't being watched. And it's very hard to square that circle. I mean, I don't really have any answers about that. I do think, though, that the focus on behaviors is very important. And for organizations to also acknowledge that it's going to be your behaviors that are going to transmit culture. So if the leadership say one thing and do another and are not accountable in that sense, then what they do is actually going to set the agenda. I know this very acutely because I have 3-year-olds, and they very much do what we do rather than what we tell them to do, as parents. And, I hate to be that paternalistic, but I think the same principle applies.
Okay, one last question, I think.
So, a question for anyone on the panel. Enjoyed your talk. The role of the chief risk officer in all of this. We know what the board has to do. We know what staff have to do. What about the second line of defence? What's their role?
Yeah, so, you know, I'm kind of agnostic about what the title is, you know, whether they're called the chief risk officer, I think, you know, currently the kind of confusion about whether the chief actuary or the appointed actuary role is first line of defense or second line of defense. And apparently we're able to do both, but the CFO isn't or something like that, which yeah, just as, I won't put Stuart on the spot. We've had this conversation for a long time. So, you know, I have a personal view that I think that for certain organizations, appointed actuary should be second line of defense, and that, in fact, this is what we should be doing all the time. And that, actually, the first line is very much a function, actuarial function, that should be done as a function and separated from the office of the appointed actuary. And so anybody can do that as long as it's signed over. So anyway, that's a separate talk. So within my mind then, I whether you call them the chief risk officer or the chief actuary, I still think the same principles apply, and that hopefully this structure and idea is useful to chief risk officers as well as actuaries. And my particular bent that I think actuaries can be the chief risk officer as well.
I wonder if this is sort of a top-down approach, and I wonder if there's room for a more of a bottom-up kind of thinking about this as well. I mean, I have never seen a corporate disaster where there wouldn't have been dozens of people in the institution who knew the wrong thing was being done, and yet the culture or something stop the whistleblower impact. So I wonder if there's some way of encouraging that, the whistleblower impact, to kind of deal with this or help or 360 degree kind of approach to them.
I think that's absolutely right. I think a lot of culture is driven by KPIs, and so there's very little KPIs at the moment in most organizations that says if you spot something and if you tell management, then you will be somehow rewarded, whether it's in the form of remuneration or other forms of benefits. All that. So I think that's just the reality of what drives human behavior. And perhaps it's time for organizations to really rethink the whole incentive structure. And from there, you will be able to get the people from the bottom up to really think through, what are some of the elements that are causing issues at the moment, and what are some of those hidden issues that will blow up in the future.
Great. I'm afraid that's time.
Can I just quickly say one thing? Yep. So the paper we've quoted at the front of this actually splits up that and talks about two approaches to doing measurements, top-down and bottom-up. We just didn't have the time to go into all that detail, but I absolutely agree. It's not just about taking the tone from the top, but it's actually about the echo from the bottom, and also how the two align, and that's what your measurement framework needs to be based around.
Thank you. Very, very topical issue. Good set of questions. So could you please join me in thanking all the speakers?